From shell suit wearing Zeus to mega rock star Orpheus, the new Netflix series Chaos is a rewriting of the Greek myths, giving them a modern twist and very wry smile along the way. The series transposes the mighty gods and mortals they toy with to the here and now, though the challenges they face remain steadfastly timeless. Anyone who has watched the series will recognise Dublin actor Cillian Scott in the role of Orpheus, who, as we know, must journey to the underworld this time without a lyre. Since his pivotal role of Tommy in Love Hate, Cillian has had roles on the big and small screen, even joining the Marvel Cinematic Universe for Secret Invasion. In Chaos, he plays a lovelorn global rock star who finds himself on an unexpected quest and caught between the whims of two powerful gods. When I spoke to Cillian Scott recently, he told me all about his work on the new Netflix series and much else besides. Before I bring you that conversation, let's hear a clip of him singing full rock star mode here as Orpheus in Chaos.
Blessed Olympia, may we submit to the gods and honour them. Controversially, I'm starting with something completely new. It's for the person who completes me, saves me repeatedly. She hates it when I say that, but it's true. She's here somewhere. Ready? I love you. With all my heart.
Is it a little too much breathing the air from your lungs? Is it a little bit much under the weight of this love? But I want to breathe your every breath. Be the truth and be the myth. Through the days and through the nights. Through the bitter life.
So, Cillian, the character of Orpheus, the great musician of Greek mythology. How much did you want to be the great musician of Greek mythology?
Well, now that I hear it described as the great musician of Greek mythology, I think I might have suggested that they could have gone somewhere else for the role. Well, it's a funny one because as an actor, you know, you never quite know what it is. I don't anyway. There's never any plan and I never really have a sense of what I necessarily want to do next. And then a script comes in and you've never heard of it before at all, you know, and it's Chaos and Orpheus and it's a modern version. You know, it's got a quite a strong touch, I would say, of kind of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet in terms of aesthetics and everything. Whilst I supposedly am very slowly developing my own music project, I don't actually necessarily think of myself as a musician. And I certainly, Sean, do not think of myself as a vocalist. You know, those elements of this part, like there's a scene in the show where I have to play a piano piece and I don't play piano. So I learned, you know, they sort of suggested, well, is there any way you could learn this? And it was quite an elaborate advanced kind of piece. And I decided, look, I'll just learn. I think I learned Nick Cave Into My Arms, which is, as far as sort of piano pieces go, you can find a basic version that sort of is just chords that kind of works to give me something real to be doing in the room on the day, because it helps me and it helps, I think, the other cast members. And then they obviously just put whatever they want, you know, over it. And you've got sort of a sense of me actually playing the piano.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, the main song, the concert sequence, which was a song that was written by Dan Smith of Bastille. And, you know, I'm familiar with Bastille's music, but of course, when they said this to me, I immediately went on Spotify just to check out their kind of their main hits or whatever. Hmm. And they've got like several billion streams, all of these songs. And again, I sort of started to feel a sense of pressure as one might. And, you know, that scene, for anyone who's seen the show, like it's quite a big set piece. And, you know, I can't remember where I would have been, but, you know, I'm in my trailer in Spain or wherever I am. And I get a recording of the song by Dan Smith of Bastille with his vocal track. And of course I listened to it and I was like, well, it's a fantastic song. It suits the show brilliantly. But in no version of the universe will I be able to sing this piece of music. So I expressed this, you know, quite honestly to the showrunner. And you know, Charlie, who I adore, Charlie is the creator of the whole
Charlie
thing.
Covell, yeah.
Charlie Covell, yeah. And Charlie was like, don't worry, we'll find your version or this, we'll make this work, but it's going to be fine. And they put me in touch with a vocal coach in London, a woman named Anne-Marie Speed, who was an absolute game changer. Like, it's extraordinary what a person can achieve in just, you know, we had two or three sessions. She made me feel incredibly relaxed. And just, you know, any sort of, anyone who's ever thought maybe they could sing, you know, we had, like I said, only a few hours together. And she was kind of finding things in my voice that I didn't even really know were there, kind of thing. Wow. You know, with different techniques and exercises. And, you know, and we kind of got it in good shape. And then again, another sort of pinch me moment in the whole process, which, you know, this job, there was a few of those. We then recorded the vocal track in Abbey Road Studios in London.
Yeah.
So, because it's, you know, the complication of trying to sing it live was just going to be, you know, it's an additional technical difficulty that, you know, we were shooting in a very historic location in the Plaza de España in Seville. And, you know, they've built this huge stage and we have a 10-hour window, let's just say, where we have 1,000 background artists in as our audience and, you know, multiple, you know, camera people and lighting and sound and all these things. Shooting a scene like that was definitely one of those moments where it was just sort of, because it has to be such a communal effort because it's such a big sequence. And I found it very freeing in a way. Like, we did it in a very loose way in the sense that, okay, Killian, you walk down these stairs, there'll be kind of fans, you know, and you react to them, and then you walk up onto stage, and then this is roughly the area you have to play with.
Yeah.
And as is kind of my style or my approach as an actor, I don't like to sort of think about it too much. I don't like to make any decisions in advance, and I like to try and just react. When you have 1,000 people who are being told to scream, you know, when you come out.
Yeah, I have to say, I was looking at that particular moment, which is just ahead of the singing of the song, which is super in the series, as you went up through the crowd of screaming and adoring fans, the fans of Orpheus, it must be said. I felt you had very little difficulty taking on that rock star status.
I'm glad it was convincing to you, Sean, very much so. I mean, I have to say the Orpheus role, like, you know, I've had a variety of different parts over the years, you know, and I went to a drama school that was very cerebral, and it was very much you analyze everything and you think about parts and you develop a character. And I just, over years of doing it, my approach has changed somewhat. I think it's an evolving thing, so maybe it depends on the script and the other actors and director. But with Orpheus, I got a script and I sat down to, you know, the classic thing we do now is we shoot audition tapes. Very rarely you go into a casting room anymore and like do it in person. So I shot this tape, but I sat down with the script and I hadn't even started learning the scene. The scene that I had to audition with was the very first scene that Orpheus has in the show. It's when wonderful Aurora, who plays Eurydice, she comes home, and this is the first time you meet Orpheus, the character. And I hadn't even like learned the scene yet. And 30 minutes later, I was sending off the finished tape, as it were, you know, with one or two takes. And then they cast me. So the thing I kind of found from that experience was that there was just a natural connection to this part for whatever reason. Also, I was allowed to do it in my own voice, which I enjoyed. And I haven't actually done too many parts in my natural accent. But I have to tell you, Sean, like, it's always a bit of a gamble. Like, you know, when they say action, and you walk down the steps and there's all the screaming fans and you run through the fans and you run up onto stage and however then you interact with the audience, you know, you don't necessarily know it's going to come together, how it's going to come together, but it just was one of those things where the atmosphere on the evening, and then once you just hear action, you kind of just go for it. And it sort of came together in a way that I was incredibly, like, it was incredibly creatively satisfying. And then, of course, you know, you film the thing, but you don't know what you're going to see when the final cut is presented to you. And when I saw it and the way they intercut it with Eurydice's story and you see Dionysus appear and the way they did it all, I found it very, like, affecting. And It was one of those moments. It was just a great thing to be a part of.
And you mean, obviously, you're mentioning these classical characters here who are brought into a very real contemporary world in the series. Orpheus, the great musician. Dionysus, you know, the kind of the lover of all kinds of parties and everything. The son of Zeus,
yes,
who kind of has,
yes,
a bit of a daddy problem. There's a problem going on with and with, yeah, Mammy, yeah, as, yeah, well, with Hera, and Zeus, played by, of course, Jeff Goldblum. Hera, played by Janet McTeer. But this, yes, this world of Greek mythology, did your method acting send you off to pull down your Greek classics books from the shelves and to delve deep into the backstory of Orpheus, or did you just work off Charlie's script and get a Charlie Covell script?
This is an easy question. I just worked off Charlie's scripts. To a point where it almost felt slightly experimental, because I literally engaged nothing else. I didn't, you know, on some jobs, I would maybe pick a particular musician, or I would read sort of literature that, like when I did a thing called Dublin Murders a couple of years
ago, yeah.
I remember I read Albert Camus, The Stranger, or The Outsider, because I felt the tone of that. It just gave me something creatively that I felt, for some unknown reason, connected me to Rob a bit better. But with this one, it was as pure as an approach as ever I've taken, in terms of, I just thought Charlie's script was perfect. And I had a particular response to that, to the point actually, Sean, where most of the other story, I wasn't even conscious of. Like when I actually watched Chaos, a lot of these other things that were happening in the plot were fresh to me, because, yeah, I kind of just went very, I don't know, minimalist with it. I was like, look, I think I just get this part, and I'm not going to think about why that is, and I'm not going to analyze it. I think I'll just show up, you know?
Yeah, what I'm wondering is, because I've seen some of, I haven't seen all of the series, I haven't got a chance to watch all of the episodes, but what the sense that I get is that Orpheus is very much this, he's one of the human beings in the story. But then when Dionysus comes on board, who wants to get back at his father's use, and therefore wants to help Orpheus in this trip to the underworld, I get a sense that maybe we're going to have to see him go into a more otherworldly place. Obviously, if he's going down to the underworld, how real is it down there? Or do you just have to keep it real no matter where Orpheus is?
The underworld, what Charlie did with that, because when I got the part, I was like, oh yeah, the underworld. I mean, I guess it'll be like Lord of the Rings or something, you know, it'll be this mad, like, you know, Charon, the boatman across the, yeah, river Styx, will be this, you know, 30 feet tall giant guy, or like, it would just be very, you know, all the tropes of sort of fantastical things would be there. And then of course, in Charlie's brilliant mind, what they came up with was, no, the underworld is more like this Orwellian kind of East Berlin in the early 80s, kind of giant gray apartment blocks, and the underworld is shot entirely in black and white. So you've got this wonderful visual sort of clash between Earth, Olympus, and then you're in the underworld, which is all this beautiful, you know, black and white. And again, like Ramon Tikaram, this fantastic British actor, plays Charon, but you know, he just played it so naturalistically, or so naturally. Like I felt it was one of those jobs where you're playing these massive characters in terms of their history and from Greek mythology and how they've seeped into contemporary culture all the time. And yet everyone was making them smaller, or like bringing the performances to a very natural place. And actually, on that note, actually, the last thing I'd say, I think everyone was cast very, very well for their role. So like, no one has to do a thing, you know what I mean? It's like everyone can kind of just, I think everyone slipped into the skin of their characters with great ease. That was my perception. Where, I mean, if you look at Jeff Goldblum, like, I only met Jeff for the first time a week ago in London, because, you know, we don't actually have any scenes together in the show. So, and, like, I did this Marvel thing, you know, a couple of years ago, and the only reason I met Samuel L. Jackson was because I was brought to set by mistake, because I wasn't actually in the scene that they brought me to set.
Somebody got the schedule wrong.
yeah. But you know, I've had a few gigs now where you work with these incredible people and you don't actually meet them. But I met Jeff a week ago. He's a lovely, lovely guy, incredibly friendly, but he also just has this wonderful positive energy. Now, obviously, Zeus is
a little bit paranoid and a little bit insecure.
Whatever the positive sort of counterpoints of those qualities are, you know, Jeff has his bathe and, you know, but again, the energy of how he talks and how he moves and how he engages, a lot of that comes, you know, into the show with Zeus.
It sounds, I mean, I don't know how you approached Love Hate back in the day, but it sounds as if it had that kind of feel of it. And if in some ways, you know, if you think about Love Hate, there's a kind of a Greek tragedy feel to it, really, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think if you had Stuart Carlin on the phone, I think he would tell you all sorts of wonderful reference points and stories that were inspiring to him, and, you know, the Shakespearean quality of some of these stories as well. Like, all these classical references, you know, pop up because there's lots of relatable themes and concepts in them, I think. I mean, Love Hate was such a different time for me because, like, you know, Maureen Hughes, who was the casting director in Love Hate, who I often refer to as basically the architect of my career, because, you know, I had done like 4 years of amateur theater in Dublin, and then I went to a very intense drama school in London. But for years, I had been sending letters and CVs and headshots and emails. Like, once upon a time, one of the first things I remember doing when I decided I wanted to be an actor was I emailed Michael Dwyer, you know, the late, great Michael Dwyer, who was the principal film critic of The Ticket. Now, I was obsessed with The Ticket, and I was obsessed. I thought Michael Dwyer and Donald Clarke as, you know, wonderful writers. And I emailed him because I just thought, look, maybe this guy will know how to start a career. And of course, he responded very kindly. And I was like 17 at the time, and he responded, to be honest, I don't have a clue, but just, you know, the best of luck with it. But what I'm trying to say is I was always basically trying to find where were these little inroads that one could take. Mm. And I'd been sending emails, CVs and headshots for years. And just before my final year of drama school began, I sent out another bunch of them. And one of the only responses I'd gotten, again, in years, other than we'll keep you on file, was from Maureen Hughes inviting me to come to an audition for Love Hate. Wow. And, you know, that was, you know, I had just spent 2 years essentially in a classroom, and like, we rehearsed The Crucible by Arthur Miller for 3 months, 5 hours every evening to give one performance. Like, it was, this was, a drama school is quite a unique beast, but all of a sudden someone was like, come and audition for this thing. And I did. And a week later I got the part. The next day I dropped out of drama school. And on the following day I signed with my agent, who was then my agent for 10 years. And that agent was also representing Michael Fassbender and Paddy Considine. So like, and then a week later I was on set with Tom Von Lawler, Robert Sheehan, Aidan Gillen, Charlie Murphy, you know, all these wonderful actors. So all of a sudden it moved from the most, you know, stereotypical classroom, you know, actor in training to you're bang on set. You're actually being paid to act, which was such a kind of unusual concept to me at the time. And you're with all these wonderful, serious professional actors, and the career has kind of kicked off. But like, I was so green. Like, I didn't have a clue. I remember one day walking to set on Love Hate, and I had like three of the full scripts in like a backpack in case they decided to randomly pick up other scenes, which, any, you know, anyone who knows anything about filmmaking, like, these days are tightly scheduled. Yeah. You don't just, you need to set up lights and whatever, food trucks and stuff. I had just come from my training. So like with Tommy, I read all these crime books, and I went to the forecourts like kind of in costume, and, you know, and then you're walking around just talking in the accent the whole time. Like, it was a very different time in my career and a different kind of role.
Yeah.
And, you know, you evolve, hopefully, like, over different gigs, and you learn different things. And like, I had a very instructive experience once. I got this big, big part. I mean, it had huge potential. Unfortunately, it ended up being canceled after one season, but, you know, in the moment it could have been, you know, it was called Damnation, and it was a big American show. It was my first real lead show, and it was American accent and set in 1931, a big period piece. I got cast in that 4 days before we started filming.
Wow.
Because they had, for some reason, the director and an actor, it wasn't going to work. the writer had seen me in a film called 71 and was like, let's see if this guy is free. And 4 or 5 days later, I was in Canada, you know, signing a contract for a 7 seasons lead role in this big American show. Like, as I said, it didn't work out in the end. But on that job, I didn't have time to do anything. I didn't have time to, all I had time to do was sharpen up my American accent and learn the lines, because it was an incredibly verbose character. It was a guy who was basically pretending to be a preacher to sort of galvanize like a Marxist revolution. And which is kind of a mad role now that I say it out loud. But when we started filming, it just felt so good and it felt so natural. I was really, really happy with the work on that, in that role.
You make it sound easy, Killian, but of course, to make it look as if you're doing nothing is the real skill of the actor. Listen, congratulations on the performance. It's quite a journey from Love Hate through many of those films you mentioned, the Marvel Universe, now with this and Dublin Murders. You know, there's a huge, even those things alone give you the accolades that you deserve. And I hope that this brings lots of good things to you. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, Killian.
It's been lovely, Sean. Thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
And that was Killian Scott. What a wonderful conversationalist he is. He appears as Orpheus in Chaos, and it is currently available on Netflix. Now, to our album reviews on this Friday evening. We will be hearing about Snow Patrol with The Forest Is The Path. We spoke to frontman Gary Lightbody on the show yesterday. First album in 6 years from the band, tinged with loss and transition. Founding members Gary Lightbody and Nathan Connolly navigate their new trio formation. Corkman John Spillane releases Fear Ishka, The Legend of the Loch, transports us into a mythological world with an ambitious Irish folk opera, takes his inspiration from a 200-year-old Victorian fairy tale, reimagines it with a cast of vocalists across a sprawling 24-track opus. And finally, London Grammar's The Greatest Love marks the band's fourth album. Noticeable shift in tone here. I suppose you would know them for their ethereal soundscapes and the vocals of Hannah Reid. The group blends introspective lyricism with Balearic-tinged beats. Did you know that? I didn't. I'm joined now by Simon Marr and Louise Bruton. And let's start with Snow Patrol and a track called Your Heart Home. I thought I would see and hear both Simon Marr and Louise Bruton singing along to that chorus, such as the nature of a Snow Patrol chorus. It's practically impossible not to sing along with it, even if you don't know it. That is Your Heart Home from Snow Patrol and the new album, The Forest Is The Path. Louise, how have things changed for Snow Patrol from go right back to the 1990s? I'm sure you're only listening to them now in Northern Ireland, and their huge success with tracks like Run and Chasing Cars.
So they started as a university band, and they kind of went for more of a sort of shoegazy, self-deprecating rock indie sound. Strangeness kind of lived at the centre of what their sound was, which is a stark removal to what we just heard there. But their first two albums, Songs for Polar Bears in 98 and the 2001s, When It's All Over, We Still Have to Clear Up, were critically acclaimed albums. But at that same time, they found themselves performing to crowds of 18 people in strip clubs, and then having to fund the £200 themselves to try to be longlisted for the Mercury Prize, which they did not achieve at all. But by the time 2002's Final Straw came along, they landed on this kind of critical and commercial point that a lot of people strive for. It was that comfortable level of success, and it was hit after hit with Run, Chocolate, and Spitting Games. Run eventually became this X Factor chewed out and spit out power ballad. Leona Lewis had, if not a number one hit single with it, top 10 at the most. And their next album, 2006's Eyes Open, everything changed for them when their song Chasing Cars ended up on Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, that was the big breakthrough. Although Gary Lightbody was adamant last night when he was talking to me that Run was for him the big moment, and the big moment for him was none of those versions of it, but the crowd at Electric Picnic singing the chorus by themselves. I mean, that's what they do. You can hear it there, the big anthems, the big choruses, and it's sing-along time.
Oh, it is. It is. And they do huge choruses and they know. But you do feel, and I think particularly on this, on The Forest is the Path, there's an amount of conflict now.
Yeah, which, talk about a little bit about the personal side, because he had a tough, I suppose the last album was full of personal stuff, but now he's kind of in a new place.
It is. Like I think this is more, I suppose, looking back on what were actually some bad times for, you know, whereas probably six years ago when the last album was released, he was in the midst or on the verge of an awful lot of the stuff that was going to happen. The band almost imploded, you know, in the very early 2020s. They went down to a trio, and they had been a very solid unit for the previous 20 years before that. And now when they're singing is that there's the songs there that are huge, huge anthems, but there's a lot of the stuff where he is much more introspective, you know, and the songs become that bit more, that become slower for a start, probably don't have the huge choruses. But it's a very interesting when you listen to it in terms of when you get a song like that, massive chorus, and then you get one where he's actually quite hard on both himself and his past. And that's not something that perhaps we're all that used to from that sort of 2006 to 2018 version of the band.
And when he's doing that type of confessional stuff, how does he manage to marry that with this big stadium sound, which is, you know, you think, well, that's way less intimate than the lyrics suggest.
Well, the thing about Gary Lightbody is that he is an incredible vocalist. He can take a very simple lyric and he can put years of experience and years of emotions into it. And that is, I think, that is like the crux of Snow Patrol's success, really. It's his ability to emote. But I do feel that now that they are down to a trio, there is just a certain element missing from them. I feel like every song almost reaches that point where it is a stadium anthem, but it just doesn't land for me at all.
Okay, well, we're going to listen to the title track from the album, The Forest is the Path. And they are a trio, but in the chorus of this song, they become a quintet with the addition of two vocalists. And your starter for 10 is, who are the two vocalists singing with Snow Patrol in this chorus? I'll give you a hint, they are related in some way to two of the band members. So there you go. Can either of you, Simon Marr, Louise Bruton, tell me, I'm not sure if Nathan McCann, Nathan and Connolly rather, and Johnny McDade are actually singing there, but there are two other vocalists definitely singing in the chorus. Do you know who they are?
We'd say two well-known female actors, very definitely in that. One Irish, one American.
I'll stop
of Irish
teasing,
descent.
Just say their names.
I'll take one. I'll take Sarah Green.
Yeah.
And Courtney Cox, married to Johnny McDade.
Yes, and Sarah Green, I think, involved with Nathan Connolly. So there you go. That's who is in the big chorus there. Overall, does this album work for you, Simon, and how many stars?
Do you know, I think I wanted to like this album more than I did. And I think I like the honesty of Gary Lightbody in this. But like Louise says, it just doesn't hit enough times. So I'm going to give it 2.5 out of 5.
2.5 out of 5. What are you saying, Louise?
It's the same score as Simon. But I wish Gary Lightbody well. I wish them no ill.
I have to say he was the nicest man in the world to talk to last night.
5 stars for his loveliness.
He certainly is very open and nice conversationist. I've had several of them this week, not least of whom was him, Killian Scott, and earlier in the week I had Juliet Stevenson. I mean, 3 great conversations. But there you go. Let us move on to album number 2. You're still only giving the music 2.5. We're giving him 5.
Yes.
Let us move on to John Spillane, described as a musician, songwriter, performer, recording artist, storyteller, poet and dreamer. And all of those things are present, it has to be said, on his latest album, Fear Ishka, which he calls his magnus opus. He's certainly doing, it's a very ambitious project this, Louise.
Yes, I felt like I was cramming for my leaving cert. The amount of work that he's put into this album is completely evident. He normally, when we are given kind of preview links to albums, we're given a 1-page bio. But for this, we got a 190-page composition score to have a look at. We had a 61-page doc to go through all of the lyrics because it's a bilingual album.
Irish and English,
And some of the inspiration, like as you said earlier on, there's 200-year-old poems that led to the inspiration of this. There's stories about the Fianucht. There's Sean O'Tuma's work with An Companas Corcaigh, the theatre Cork. Cork Theatre production company, and then a poem, Sprid on Lucca by Turner. So these are
only,
all things.
That's only a touch of what has inspired.
And of course, we all know what they're all about. So,
you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff for sure happening here. Let's have a listen to how that turns itself into music. Tubbereen, Little Well. There we go. Tubbereen, or Little Well, from Act One, Scene One yes. of Fiorishka, The Legend of the Loch, the magnus opus of John Spillan that we're speaking about this evening. Some of the people that are on this, there's John Spillan himself, obviously, as one of the major vocalists in that, but the other singers and people involved, quite an extraordinary list, Simon.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Like, he's got the likes of Ona Canavan, who plays the part of the king, Regna Connolly as the queen, Niamh Farrell as Fiorishka herself.
Yeah.
And what's brilliant about it, one of the things that I like about it so much, is that they're all completely invested in this.
Yeah.
This isn't, I've walked into a studio, I've sang me a few lines,
and
I'm gone again. Yeah. You can tell. And I suppose that itself is tribute to John Spillane himself.
Yeah.
That he will have gone, and anybody who's ever talked or even heard John Spillane speak or perform will know that he's going to draw you in. And if you're in, you're properly in on this.
He's telling, we won't get into the plot, but basically it's a love story.
It
effectively,
is.
You know, how are you going to find, how the prince and the princess going to find each other?
Yes.
Kind of thing. There's a quest element.
But it's dense.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot. There's eating and drinking as you get from one end of this to the other. But I'd say everybody who's in is in.
Yeah, and it has the feel of something that, because initially when I saw it, I thought, oh, is this a recording of an opera that went on? It has the feeling that it needs and wants to be performed live in front of an audience.
Well, it is going to be connected to a site-responsive art exhibition that's happening in the Loch in Cork City. The Loch is of which the Fiorishka is supposedly the site of the underwater kingdom.
Right. Yeah.
And that is with the artist Megan Clancy. So the concept album was created with that.
Yeah.
But when you're listening to this, it's such a, it requires visuals because you have sprites and you have fairies and all of these, we heard quite direct singing there in that sample, but they're playing characters.
Yes.
And you have like voices of goblins and all sorts of things
going
on.
So some speaking, just spoken pieces as well as singing pieces. And it isn't all the lovely, gentle tubbereen that we just heard. Some of it is a little harsher than all of that. Let's have a listen to another track a bit further. This is from Act 2, Scene 2. So we're well into the work at this point. And it's called, the track is called Cugga or War. And as you can hear, you know, you have that kind of martial thing going on as well. Cugga or War there from John Spillane, from Fiorishka, Legend of the Loch. Niamh Farrell, Ona Canavan, Nellie Cronin. I think Nellie Cronin might be the main voice in that. I'm open to correction to that. And Raina Connolly. I mean, just an extraordinary set of things that I want to listen to again, but I definitely want to see. Overall, did it work for you, Louise, and Stars?
Well, it's undeniably genius. It's a masterpiece. I was also terrified of it. So five, I think, out of fear,
Five out of fear. There might be a curse on you because there is a track called Moloch.
Definitely.
Or curse. So if you don't give it five, you could be in trouble. Are you going to be brave or not, Simon?
There's real pressure now. Do you know, I found myself, as I was listening to it over the 24 tracks, there's some tracks are 10 and 11 minutes long.
Yes.
And I found myself drifting away sometimes. But then you would be brought back by something that was so utterly mad.
Yes.
You know, but it was like, okay, I think I want to get back in on this story again. So, you need to see this, and I think this is definitely worth many hours of your time. So I'm going to give it 4.
A solid 4. I think you'll be safe. There's no curse for a 4, right out. Fiorishka, the music of John Spillane, and I will be asking John Spillane lots about Fiorishka, I'm sure, next Friday when he's with us on Culture Night. Let us move on to album number 3, The Greatest Love from London Grammar, English indie pop band's follow-up to 2021's California Soil. Here's the opening track called House. I and it's very clear that if you're going to go into her house, you're going to have to play by her rules. That is the opening track on London Grammar's new album, The Greatest Love. London Grammar, Dan Rothman and Dominic Dot Major, but really it's the vocals of Hannah Reid that are driving this trio, isn't it, Louise?
Yeah, Hannah Reid has always been so distinctive about this band. Her vocals have this haunting quality to them, which has dominated their previous outputs entirely. So it is nice to hear her take almost a lighter approach to her vocal delivery. And I have found that this album is more digestible and more accessible than their previous work, which could work against them or for them, depending on how you feel about that. But that song in particular is a far more kind of party leaning song.
Yeah, it's one of the dancier type of ones, and I suppose they come from that the Ministry of Sound label, so the kind of the EDM you might expect it to be in there. What is she singing about across the entire album, though?
That is one thing, and that's one change. Like I always worry when artists get married or have kids or do any of that sort of.
And become, they shouldn't be at that they, now.
But,
should that?
But
lark?
They shouldn't be happy, right? Because happiness doesn't always necessarily lead to great tunes. But it's as if over time that she has become quite angry, and this is that idea of this is my house, these are my rules. She's very much laying down the law on this, and they're very, very strong stories and very, very definite stories. So whether it's stories about, you know, people who perhaps she doesn't think that much of anymore and perhaps a lot of their habits, or like entire areas of the industry, so misogyny and all of that. So she's quite angry all the way through this, and it does bring her vocal even more to the fore if anything that is possible there. But it does, for me, it does drop the music a little bit into the background.
The second track on the album is called Fakest Bitch, and there's a sense that, you know, she's talking about a friend associated with a boyfriend.
Exactly. At a bar,
happy about that one. But it does make its way down to the final track of The Greatest Love. So is there a happy ending here?
There is a happy ending in a way. There's a nice build up to the final track where she's kind of learning about the type of people that she attracts and maybe is exploring, is there something that maybe she's doing to attract that? And she, The Greatest Love is for herself.
And she gets there at the end. Stars from you on this one, Louise?
4 stars for me.
Solid 4. And Simon?
I'm going to give this 3.5.
3.5 from Simon for London Grammar and The Greatest Love. Before that, we heard Fearishka from John Spillane, and starting the whole thing out, The Forest is the Path from Snow Patrol. Thank you to Louise Bruton and Simon Marr for their opinions on those. And that is our lot for this Friday evening.